and welcome to Best Girl Grip, the podcast that celebrates the women behind the scenes of the British film industry. I'm your host, Nicole Davis.
Hello, pod pals. I hope you all had a very proud and loving weekend. I went to my first drag show on Friday night with the glory takeover of the River Stage at National Theatre, and just wow. It truly is an art form. It was so joyous and unabashed, and it's definitely given me the desire to see more. Also, just I want to be able to dance like that, frankly. In terms of films, I also saw Ghost World for the first time, which is currently on Mubi, and thought it was touching and sad and sardonic. Also, can anyone confirm for me, there's a scene in that film where Scarlett Johansson is flat hunting and she lifts down this ironing board from a cupboard and is like, oh my god, this is great, or something to that effect. And I swear this exact thing happens in the ensemble rom-com He's Just Not That Into You, also with ScarJo. And I wonder if they did that knowingly. But it's more likely that they didn't. But anyway, on to this week's guest. This is the first of my recorded interviews from the Edinburgh Film Festival. It was a joy to sit down with Flor Cusker, who heads up the Talent Development Department at the Scottish Documentary Institute. SDI are based at the Edinburgh College of Art and specialise in documentary training, production and distribution, supporting filmmakers through their diverse programme of international activities and training schemes. Flor and I discuss why she left behind a career in film production, as well as the process of producing her first feature documentary, Freedom Fields. The film follows three women and their football team in post-revolution Libya as the country descends into civil war and the utopian hopes of the Arab Spring begin to fade. I will link to the film in the show notes for upcoming screenings happening around Europe. This is episode 26 of Best Girl Grip. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me. We're here in Edinburgh, kind of adjacent to your offices in the Scottish Documentary Institute. Before we get onto what you do with that organisation, can you kind of give us a potted history of how you got into the film industry? Where did you start?
It was an interesting journey where I started and where I am now. I studied English literature at university, and then I was lucky enough to be part of a workshop where we got to direct 16mm short film. Cool. And it was there when I was literally developing with my own hands the film that I really thought, oh, that there could be a career there. I didn't know what I was doing, didn't quite know what I was interested in, but I knew that I had such a passion for film that I wanted to pursue it somehow. So I then moved to studying cinema, but in a more theoretical way. So nothing hands-on, just studying films and writing about films, which was very satisfying and very gratifying. But I didn't quite know what I would do with it. I think it was just such a pleasure to be doing it, but I didn't quite know how to make a career out of it. And then as I was starting my PhD in cinema, I got an offer to work on a series that was being filmed in Marseille. I'm from the south of France. Mm-hmm. It was a 6 month position, being a production assistant. And I thought, why not? So I dropped everything, dropped my PhD, and started that crazy life of working on film sets. So this series led to another few films in the south of France, always in the production department. And then I moved to Paris and continued working, but I moved to more second AD roles or location managers roles. So for 6 years, I worked in fiction mostly. So for television a lot and for blockbusters, which was really removed from what my original dreams were, because I was really keen on working in independent cinema. Right. So after a while, I think the pressure, the lifestyle, the fact that you have to work on these very commercial projects, you have for 4 months, you're working day and night nonstop. I think it kind of started to wear me down, and I thought, is that really for me? Can I sustain this for much longer? Yeah. Especially when you're at the very low in the food chain, you have to, you really have to be completely driven. And I think I had my reservation as to the project I was working on. So then I decided to move back to Marseille and to figure out what I wanted to do next. I did think that I was going to try and stop working in the film industry because I think it was quite an intense experience and very tiring. So moved back to Marseille, and that's where I started working in documentary film in the production side of things. So I worked there for a few years with an amazing company where creative documentary is really a religion. So I've learned, the producer I was working with taught me everything about how to work with documentary filmmakers, and he's an incredibly passionate man who is so committed to the project and the filmmakers that, yeah, I learned a lot. But I think I knew Marseille was only going to be a short moment. I wanted to explore something else. So I came to Edinburgh because I fell in love with Edinburgh. I came for a weekend and I decided that's the kind of place where I would like to move and live. And then I was really lucky because just after I moved to Edinburgh, I got an interview for Scottish Documentary Institute. They were looking for someone who had, I suppose, a bit of a drive and a passion for documentary and a bit of an understanding as well of the European scene, which was something I had. So yeah, they hired me and I've been working there since. So it's been 9 years.
Also, did you know moving to Edinburgh that Scotland had a documentary scene, or it was sort of like a discovery for you to realise there was an institute here? And
just before moving to Scotland, I had read about the institute. And I think for me, moving from the production side of things to a more institutional side of things was quite different. I knew Scotland had a documentary industry, but I didn't know they had an institute. And that was a revelation for me. And I suppose discovering all the work they were doing to promote Scottish films abroad, but also to promote documentary within Scotland, that really got me excited. At the moment, currently, my role at the Institute is supporting talent, which means I am involved in training programs for emerging filmmakers and producers, mostly Scotland-based filmmakers, but we do have a few opportunities for people from the rest of the UK or even international filmmakers. We also run masterclasses all year long, trying to expose the Scottish scene to various influences and from filmmakers, editors, producers, and we also run an international pitching forum, which is for definitely more experienced filmmakers, and variety of training programs. So our main program is called Bridging the Gap, and it's for 10-minute films aimed at the big screen, so for festival distribution and for the cinemas. We also have a collaboration with broadcasters, so at the moment we have this initiative called Right Here, which aims at developing 30-minute films for BBC Scotland. I'm trying to cover all bases and trying to raise awareness around what creative documentary is, so people don't think immediately, oh, you're making wildlife films or travel documentaries. I love them.
I mean, this might be quite a hard question to do under pressure, but can you kind of explain what creative documentary is to you and how you maybe describe it to other people?
I think it's anything that is not following a specific format, and that is ambitious, that has a strong story and strong protagonist at its core. And I suppose with creative documentary, you learn a lot more through the emotions, and it can be very subtle, it can be very dramatic, it can be punch in the stomach. Creative documentary for me has this incredible ambition and is cinema.
I think as well, I was at Sheffield Dockfest recently and they were talking a lot about calling it non-fiction instead of documentary, because I think that is quite a loaded term. Like, people just think of maybe school or being educated when they think about documentary. And what do you love about the talent development space?
It keeps me on my toes all the time. So it forces me to constantly learn and to constantly be aware of what's happening out there. It challenges my perspective on things as well, because I think that when you work in production, solely in production, it's quite easy to get into a format where you do always the same thing. You apply the same systems to everything, and you don't get to question yourself necessarily, unless, of course, you're quite high up. Whereas in talent development, you have to be completely open-minded. You have to adapt to the people you're working with and see what do they need in order to express themselves and to express what they have in their heads and turn it into a film. So that's very exciting. And also, it's being involved at the development stage is for me the most exciting moment because, I don't know, I love being a sounding board or being able to help people at that stage and then let them fly away and develop their own projects.
Yeah.
And I mean, the Institute and has had a really great success rate with Bridging the Gap because quite a lot of the people, directors who made Bridging the Gap films have since developed and directed their first features. Some have already done two features. So that's something I'm really happy and proud of.
Something that I've been quite aware of is I feel like Scotland sort of punches above its weight internationally in terms of, you know, it's quite small, but it has a really kind of international footprint. And I'm wondering if you know why that might be or what it is about the culture and the filmmakers that come from it that make it distinctive and able to kind of produce that really high quality content.
Well, I want to think that the Institute had its part to play, and Noe Mandel, who's the director of the Institute, has been absolutely instrumental in developing the documentary scene in Scotland. There was already the filmmakers and the talent were already there, but I think just offering opportunities to travel, to show the films abroad, and to just be there to support and give advice, that's a big part of it. Also, we're lucky because Screen Scotland are very supportive and very with an international outlook and very open-minded as to the projects that they will be supporting. One of the examples, I suppose, is Freedom Fields, the film I've produced, which is a Scottish-Libyan co-production, which is very, it says it all. I mean, for Screen Scotland have supported the film during the development and the production, and for them to say, yes, we are going to help you make this film because you're based in Scotland and this is the kind of story we want to be part of. That's quite bold.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. I saw it at CPH Docs. It's a really kind of uplifting, inspiring film. But can you talk about, how a co-production even works? Who came on board first? Who brought it to you? And what your involvement looked like in that?
So I met Naziha, the director, in Libya because we were running documentary workshops there with the British Council, and Nazia was one of the participants, and we kept in touch, and at the time she was based in Tripoli, so she was brought up in the UK but moved to Libya during the revolution, and we kept in touch, and she was updating me on life in Tripoli, and she said, oh, I've met this incredible team of women and I think there might be potential for a feature there. And that's how the collaboration started, really. It was just her. She had raised a bit of money. She'd raised money from the It for Berta Fund and Sundance for the development of the film. But I think she had reached that stage where she felt she could, you know, she could do with having someone else on board to give a hand. So it was a very natural co-production in a way because I knew Libya. She knew I really wanted to be involved in a Libyan project. So that's how it all started. And then the co-production, so Naziha had a production company in Libya, but of course it's very tricky because in Libya you don't have a film fund, you don't have money available, etc. So in that case, I suppose the co-production is more a reflection of two countries coming together to make a film, and all the money that Naziha raised through her company was international funding rather than Libyan funding.
Yeah. And did you spend quite a lot of time out there during production?
Not really, because every time I would go to Libya, so I went to Libya several times, but every time it was with the British Council, so we had some very strict rules on not leaving the hotel. So I was not really involved in the production on the field. Yeah. I met the protagonist, and I was in touch with Naziha, and we were working together, but remotely. And I suppose that's only when she came back to the UK for the post-production that we got to work in the same place, which was pretty nice.
And it was your first feature documentary. Yes. And did it kind of remind you of working in production at the beginning of your career? And has it given you a taste to continue doing that kind of work?
Yeah, I think nothing prepares you for your first documentary as a producer, especially when it's such a love story. In a way, it was a film that took about 5 to 6 years to get made. It's a long time. It was a very intense and intensive project. The fundraising has been quite a journey. It's not easy. It's such a commitment. But I suppose the reason why we started the collaboration with Nazir in the first place was because I told her, I promise you, I will help you make the film you want to make. Mm. So it meant making sure we worked with funders with no strings attached, or not too many strings attached in terms of funding, in terms of editorial control. And we were amazingly lucky because everyone who came on board was supportive of Nazir's vision, but it did take quite a long time. So I think I was more, my background was more in production in fiction, and the documentaries I was involved with in France were maybe not as intense. So yeah, you can say that nothing prepares me for this experience.
What was it like seeing it with an audience for the first time?
It was incredibly stressful. So the film premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in September.
Amazing.
Which was quite an incredible honour, and it was very scary. But we had like a full house and standing ovation, and one of the main protagonists had managed to get a visa to come to Toronto. So it was a very, very special experience.
And what kept you motivated throughout those 6 years when, you know, there might be ups and downs? Was it promising Nazir that you wanted to make the film that she had the vision for?
I think the protagonists wanting to do everything I could to make sure their story was heard and shown. I suppose in documentary, you work with real people. You work with real stories. And that's something you have to respect. And you need to do everything you can to bring the film to completion. So I think that was the ultimate drive. They were brave and generous enough to share their stories with us. So you have a huge responsibility.
And coming back to working at SDI, what does your day-to-day look like? What are your hours like? Can you talk a bit about the kind of the logistics of working here?
Just a quick note, so actually my role as a producer on Freedom Fields was pretty much an evening and weekend.
Right, so it was on the side of...
Pretty much on the side, although SDI got involved after a while, but so that makes for quite interesting and long days.
I can imagine.
But my days at the Institute, because I'm working across so many different programs, I would say the days are quite surprising. We have the programs that we run every year, so we have a calendar, and it's a lot of admin, it's a lot of going through applications, reading the submissions and selecting them, but also being involved in the communication, promoting promoting our projects, a lot of thinking about who we could bring for master classes, who might be useful and who is influential or making something interesting on the scene at the moment. So we're a small team but very passionate, and we work across many different fields. The hours are quite long and we have a lot of weekend workshops and things like that, so yeah, not you don't have a day looking like the other day. And there's also the more boring things, reporting and funding applications and things like that. So it's a balance, I would say. It's a balance between admin work, also quite a lot of tracking to make sure that we know who's doing what, and to make sure we know where we can help. Quite a bit of industry work as well, keeping yourself up to date on what's happening, traveling to a few festivals. And then the creative side is more sporadic, in the sense that it's probably when we run the workshops, when you're involved in giving feedback, passing on feedback, and execing some of the shorts. So it's that balance between those elements.
And what's your favorite part of the job?
Funny enough, I love making budgets. I'm in love with Excel. Yeah, it's one of my... I really like doing budgets because, for me, it's... a lot of people just see that as an endless list of figures and it's so boring. But actually, they do tell stories. And it's how to make what's on the paper work with your budget. And I really like that. Of course, the creative side, being a sounding board, being able to be there and help where you can, that is very interesting. But there is a lot of work around that needs to be done.
And coming back to obviously producing Freedom Fields on the side, because I kind of didn't realize that was sort of independent to what you do here. So how did that work? How did you prioritize your time?
So for a long time during the production, it was intense moments where you would have to work on a filming application together or travel to a festival because the film was presented at the Meat Market and Sheffield Dockfest and in various places. So you would have those intense moments of, I need to focus on this and that's it. And helping organizing some of the shoots. But then I suppose when the film went into the edits, there was a lot more work involved.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, I'm lucky enough that everyone who works at the Institute is also one way or another a practitioner, so either producer or filmmaker.
Mm.
So you have a lot of flexibility. And as I said, once we raised more production money, I was able to build the work more in my schedule. Mm. And but it does require a huge amount of commitment and work, and also a huge amount of unpaid work. Mm. And I think Nazira has been carrying the project for so long, and the amount of energy she has invested in this film is unbelievable. I don't think people quite realize when they watch the film the amount of work it takes. And I suppose when you make a film in 2 years, it's okay because you actually get properly paid for it.
Mm.
But when it just spreads across such a long period of time, yeah, and that sense of responsibility is you need to be committed, I would say.
Sure. I mean, you get a small sense of that in the film, I think, when they're sort of, they're building up to going to the abroad to compete in the championships, and then they kind of get let down, and there's that protracted period for them of figuring out how to make it work. Yeah, no, I was going to talk about the documentary funding space, because you're obviously then quite well equipped to talk about both sides as a producer and then someone that works in an institute. Do you feel like it's a particularly positive time to be working in documentary? There's a lot of opportunities out there to get funding, or what do you think we could be doing more as a sector to be supporting our filmmakers?
It's an interesting time for sure, because I think there is more than ever an appetite for documentary and for all different kinds of documentaries. So that's quite exciting. And I suppose there are a lot of filmmakers and production companies working on very exciting projects. However, the funding situation is very complex and very, very difficult, especially for first-time filmmakers. I think in the UK, there is a support system in place and there are opportunities, but it's still quite small compared to countries like Germany or France, for instance, where I think documentary is supported. You have a lot more sources of funding available. I suppose in the UK, it forces you to be quite creative. It forces you to really think outside the box, maybe think of private investment routes, maybe think of different types of fundings which are not film funding but will be connected to your projects one way or the other, crowdfunding. So it's a bit like the situation in America, although the situation in America for documentary is way worse because there's absolutely no money outside of philanthropic or private investment. Right. But yeah, I think it's an interesting yet very tough time for filmmakers.
And have you noticed that it's become worse? Or yeah, what's been your view of it changing since you've been at Scottish Documentary Institute?
I think it's become more of a struggle. There are more and more documentaries being developed, so it's quite competitive. Also, you think that the situation with Brexit and the support of Creative Europe, which might be withdrawn quite soon, I mean, all this is very, very concerning. And there's just and the funding bodies are very, very supportive, but they also have limited budgets. So yeah, it's a bit of a tricky time. When you think also with Freedom Films, we're incredibly lucky to have funders on board like Chicken and Egg Pictures and Sundance Film Institute and Itfa Berta Fund. But these funds are so highly competitive. I mean, I think I was talking to a funding specialist from America a few days ago, and she was saying that I think the admission rate at Harvard is 10%. The chances of getting funding from Sundance Film Institute are at 5 or 4%. So literally, you have more chances of being accepted to Harvard than getting funds from Sundance. Uh-huh. So yeah, that gives you an idea of the struggle and the competition out there.
Yeah, big time. And where do you see your career going? In turn, would you kind of like to encompass the more creative production side into your career as a whole, or staying here doing the talent development work?
I think I'm ready to go back for a little bit at really focusing on talent development and until I fall in love with another project. Yeah, I think working with Scottish-based or Scotland-based talent and really helping them in their first experience, or making that transition from academia or a career in television, etc., that move into creative documentary or into another side of the industry, making it a bit easier, is something that I really enjoy and I really feel passionate about.
And how do you go about doing that, bringing someone from TV into the filmmaking side? What does that sort of journey look like, and how do you facilitate that?
I think we've had quite a few people who did a Bridging the Gap film after they had worked in television for several years. Yeah. It's quite interesting because half of them went back to television, and, you know, I can't blame them. The creative documentary or nonfiction route is quite a tough one, and not everyone gets a chance to make their own film, etc. But I think that it was a desire to expand their world a little bit, or to expand their skills as filmmakers. And sometimes it's quite difficult to kick your TV instincts, because documentary is really about spending a lot of time with the people, not just going in, getting the story and out again. But it's always been very, very interesting and challenging for them, and they've all really enjoyed it, whether they went back to TV or decided to embrace the documentary career.
And who's a woman that you work with that you'd like to spotlight as being someone that you find particularly inspirational or that you love working with?
Well, I'm just going to stay very close to home. on Freedom Feels, we ended up with an almost all-female team. Mm. Not necessarily just by choice. It was also more finding inspiration and meeting people and feeling that they really engage with the film. Mm. So, of course, for me, Nazia, the director, is a talent to watch, and she's got a few projects on the go that definitely something to look out for in the coming years. And we were lucky to work with an amazing editing team. So we had three editors on board: Ling Lee, who's based in Scotland, Alice Powell, who is based in London, and Maya Hawke, who's also based in London. And I think these three editors they each have very, very specific talent, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they're going to be involved in next.
That's really interesting. So were they working on different segments, or were they kind of in collaboration with each other?
They worked in different sessions, so because the editing took quite a lot of time, and because, you know, life happens and conflicting schedule, etc. So Ling was involved in the first part of the film, where she basically brought the film to the assembly, so it had to go through hours and hours and hours of footage, and then Alice came on board and was absolutely instrumental in finding the structure, making the structure of the film work. And Maya was the last one to come on board. She was absolutely amazing. It's making the film a film for the big screen. So, I mean, they could have all have worked on the different stages. It was just, I think it was a happy coincidence that they all got involved and all brought something absolutely crucial to the film.
I always end the podcast with asking, what's a film that you've seen recently by a woman director that you think is undervalued? I'm assuming it will be a documentary, but if it isn't, can you also spotlight a documentary that you think people should be watching?
Actually, it's not a documentary, and it's an old film, a film from the 70s, which I've watched again recently. It's called Wanda by Barbara Loden. It's an incredible film and an incredible story for the filmmaker as well. So I would recommend people to watch it, because Barbara Loden made the film in the mid-70s, so in the middle of the new Hollywood and surrounded by incredible filmmakers, but she never, I think, got the recognition she deserved. So I think that's one of the underestimated gems that is worth rediscovering, but it's fiction. In terms of documentary, there's so many. There's a documentary co-production between Sweden and Scotland called Scheme Birds, which is showing at the Edinburgh International Film Festival at the moment. And it won the best documentary at Tribeca. And I think it's an incredibly bold and beautiful documentary. Mm-hmm. So definitely if it's showing in a festival near you, or when it hits the cinemas in the UK, go and see it.
That's kind of perfect because I'm interviewing Ruth Reed next. So I think we can lead straight into that one. Floor, thank you so much for your time. This has been great.
Thank you very much.
It was really lovely to meet Floor on a very rainy afternoon in Edinburgh, and having heard quite a lot about SDI in my day job, it was fantastic to dig deeper about what they do. I also appreciated that interview because sometimes production can be put on a bit of a pedestal in the film industry, obviously because the making of the film is arguably the headline act, but I think Floor's career goes to show you can divert away from that and ultimately return to producing your own material, as well as finding filmmaking fulfillment in another realm. So on a personal level, that felt quite reassuring to hear. So I hope, as always, that was helpful for you as well. Thank you for downloading and listening to this episode. You can listen to all 25 previous episodes on iTunes, Spotify, and Acast. Next week, I have another guest for my time at the Edinburgh Film Festival, and it's the producer of Scheme Birds, which Floor mentioned there at the end. Have a good week. That's all from me.